so George kept his feelings to himself. But here's what's fascinating. Except for a short-lived dip during the AIDS epidemic, public support for gay rights climbed during every decade after the 1960s, with a significant uptick in the 2000s. The chart that graphs the U.S. population in favor of gay rights over the years looks like a hockey stick. It starts low with around 30% of people in favor of gay rights in 1979 and goes up to nearly 70% by 2014. This wasn't just coastal liberals. This was everyone. People became more accepting in religions that deem homosexuality offensive to God. Pew Research showed a growing percentage in favor of equal LGBT rights among every major American religious group. Within a generation, the majority of Americans were saying it was okay for someone who felt differently from them to love who they wanted to love. At the very least, the sentiment became, those differences shouldn't be cause for loss of rights. What could explain this phenomenon? We learned in the previous chapter about how traveling to and living among foreign cultures helps to open our minds. But the millions of Americans who changed their minds about Asian immigrants between 1945 and 2000 didn't all spend a gap year in Asia. And there wasn't some magical gaytopia across the sea to convince straight Americans that gay people weren't so scary after all, although I would totally visit that place. These two changes in attitude happened at somewhat different times. And other groups like African Americans, Arabs, and Latinos would have much less luck. And yet, one of the main factors driving these two shifts in the American psyche would ultimately be the same. Part 5. For several years, George's dream of being a famous actor was remote as ever. After getting his architecture degree, he went to theater school and began auditioning. Most parts available to a Japanese man in Hollywood in the late 1950s and early 1960s were fairly cheesy. Hysterical nitwit side characters, skeevy Fu Manchu types. When his rich bass voice got him a gig doing English voiceover for the American release of Godzilla Raids Again, George was ecstatic. But he was still swimming against the tide. George didn't tell people he was gay. His square jaw and deep voice lent themselves to the heterosexual ideal of Hollywood in its golden age. So he played into it. At the time, television portrayed homosexuals as either violent criminals or mentally ill. In one early TV episode, Marcus Welby, MD, a man comes to the doctor suffering depression and diabetes. Dr. Welby diagnoses him with homosexuality, but assures him that one day he could become normal. Other episodes painted gay people as pedophiles and rapists. The first group of lesbians on TV that I could find were homicidal killers in the show Policewoman. These tropes ignored, of course, the fact that murder and rape exist at no higher rates among gays than among straights. Over time, however, television's gay stories started to get more realistic. In the 1972 made-for-TV movie That Certain Summer, Martin Sheen and Hal Holbrook played gentlemen who lived together in secret. Another early gay character was Billy Crystal in Soap. Crystal was lovable and captivating, though his character was made to flirt with the idea of getting a sex change, as if this were something that gay people would all want. Progress was slow, and offensive stereotypes persisted. But over time, gay characters got more sympathetic, and they got more airtime. When fan favorite Ellen DeGeneres came out on TV in 1997, both as herself and as her fictional character Ellen Morgan, 42 million people tuned in. The tide had turned. Gay was mainstream. Major networks started airing more shows with recurring gay characters. The graph of the number of recurring gay television characters from 1970 to 2015 starts at basically zero, and every year the number more or less grows until it goes up sharply in the 2000s, till more than half of television shows have gay characters by 2014. It shouldn't be too surprising that as the number of people with positive attitudes toward gay people increased, so too did the way we portrayed gay people on television. In fact, I charted how many times the word gay appeared in movie and television scripts between 1965 and now, compared to the decline of a common gay slur in movie and TV scripts during the same period. Using data from Ben Schmitz and Erez Aydin's Bookworm Project, we see that in 1974, the word gay occurred about 5 times per every million words in TV scripts. In 2014, it was around 60. The other chart, showing the gay slur, charts how many times the word faggot appears in movies and TV scripts per million words. Unlike the word gay, this one started at around 7 words per million in the 1970s and has crawled down to 3 by 2014. And there's something intriguing hidden in these charts and this data. When we overlay them with our first chart of gay acceptance milestones and account for the lag time between when scripts are written and when they hit screens, which can take years, we can see that we have things backward. Hollywood didn't follow gay acceptance. Hollywood actually predicted it. We might conclude from this that Hollywood is just slightly ahead of the curve when it comes to social issues. But, as is often the case, there was something even more interesting going on. Part 6. A decade after Ellen came out, a group of people went to the theater for an unusual movie experience. The film was the latest James Bond movie, the British spy franchise created by Ian Fleming. But there was a catch. This wasn't going to be the usual Pepsi and popcorn diversion. This particular audience was going to watch the film while hooked up to an array of equipment that, from the look of it, might have come out of Q's own lab. The man behind this science experiment was neuroeconomist Paul Zak of Claremont University. While the audience watched Bond tangle with villains and flirt with disaster, Zak saw what he called an amazing neural ballet. The James Bond storyline, his instruments demonstrated, changed the activity in the audience's brains. And that brain activity made their bodies do curious things. When Bond sidled along the edge of a building, bad guys closing in, the audience's heart rates increased. Palms began to sweat. When Bond was in a tight spot, their brains registered fear. When Bond faced a gut-wrenching dilemma, the audience tensed up as if they did too. Safe in their comfy chairs, Bond's spectators were living out his drama inside their minds. Of course, this experience is common to virtually all of us. If you've ever watched a movie or been to a baseball game or comforted a friend, you've felt it. So why do we empathize? Why do we, to a greater or lesser extent, feel what we imagine others are feeling? Dr. Zak's Bond experiment showed something that surprised a lot of people. A certain neurochemical happens to be responsible for this emotional mirroring. It's a little molecule called oxytocin. Previously, oxytocin was known to play a role in pregnancy and breastfeeding, but not in much else, and certainly not in action movies. What Zak discovered is that this molecule is key to how we become open to other people and their ideas. Oxytocin is produced when we are trusted or shown a kindness, and it motivates cooperation with others, Zak explains. It does this by enhancing the sense of empathy, our ability to experience others' emotions. Empathy, of course, was important for our survival as humans. As Zak put it, it allows us to understand how others are likely to react to a situation, including those with whom we work. To prove this, Zak had people snort synthetic oxytocin and watch TV ads for charities. He allowed the test subjects to donate to any of the charities if they wanted. And guess what? The people who snorted oxytocin were 57% more likely to give to a charity they saw in one of the ads, and they donated 56% more than others. Overall, the oxytocin huffers reported feeling more concern for the people in the advertisements. Here's where it gets really interesting. Zak then conducted the same charity ad experiments without making anyone snort anything. He wanted to see what kinds of natural interactions between people would lead to oxytocin production. What makes our brains make more of it in real life? What he discovered is the neuroscientific basis for one of the most marvelous and useful techniques for building openness to other humans. In hindsight, the epiphany was simple. In one experiment, Dr. Zak had people watch charity advertisements with a narrative storyline versus ads without any story. Imagine, for example, a father talking about how his child was struggling with cancer, or an animal shelter employee describing how a pet was abused, versus ads with heartbreaking statistics about child cancer rates or pet abuse. Zak found that stories motivated people to donate significantly more money than ads that just delivered straight facts. When he analyzed test subjects' blood, Zak found that the people who'd seen the ads with stories had higher oxytocin levels. Stories stimulated oxytocin production in the brain. In the James Bond experiment, in addition to the racing hearts and sweating palms, it turned out that Zak's equipment also showed that the audience's brains made more oxytocin. Through this and similar studies, Zak's lab discovered that any time people experience character-driven stories, their brains pump out more oxytocin. So while not specifically searching for a love potion, he claims, Dr. Zack had stumbled upon the chemical explanation for what centuries of poets already knew. Stories help us fall in love. They build relationships and make us care. This idea goes back to before we even had pens to write stories down. In pre-literate societies, myths and stories were the embodiment of our shared identity. They made it easier for us to work and to survive together. In a world without Google Calendar, stories helped us to package and retain information. Our tribe's daily minutiae and our tribe's ethos and lore were alike passed by word of mouth, campfire to campfire, generation to generation. Relating and remembering stories was hardwired into our growing brains. And it turned out that because stories engage more of our senses, they help us remember that information better too. Scientists have a saying that neurons that fire together wire together. This means that when we learn something through a story that, say, evokes imagery and emotion, more neurons activate and our brains retain the information better. While stories were a great way to package information, they also held clues for who and what we should care about. The caring part was oxytocin's job. If a story was about a character, someone whose cooperation might be important for our survival, our brain would generate the kind of activity that helped us remember that person and care about them. Oxytocin's role, in part, was to get our bodies to mimic what our tribesmates were doing, from breathing to sweating to body language to emotion. If someone was part of our tribe, our brains wanted us to be, run, jump, and remember along with them. A big moment in gay television history was the 2009 debut of the fictional Kurt Hummel, played by Chris Colfer in the TV musical Glee. Kurt wasn't a token. He was an ordinary, awkward teenager coming to terms with being different and growing up. Something that every teen and former teen can relate to, gay or not. He's outspoken, sensitive, courageous, and charismatic. As the story unfolds, Kurt has to face bullies at school, come out to his father, and come to terms with a host of confusing feelings. Glee gave millions of straight viewers a window into what it's actually like to grow up gay. And, as gay journalist Alexander Stevenson put it, Kurt is not simply a statement or storyline or supporting character used to build up the diversity of the gang. He's a person. And here's the thing about Kurt. Television portrayals like his didn't predict a positive shift in attitudes toward gay people in America. They actually contributed to that shift. A study by The Hollywood Reporter found that 27% of the Americans who watched Glee or Modern Family, starring two gay dads, directly credited the shows with helping them become more pro-gay rights. The more the non-gay public was exposed to human stories about gay people, people with thoughts and feelings and families and desires and struggles like our own, the more empathy said public had for them. Oxytocin was part of the learning process that put us in Kurt's shoes. It helped make us care. Stories like these help millions to decategorize gay people as a scary stereotype, an outgroup, and see them as just people, part of our superordinate in-group. Even though political issues like gay marriage remained charged, people who saw sympathetic stories of gay people became more willing to collaborate with them. By the time Titus Andromeda was stealing scenes in 2015's The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, fewer than 19% of Americans said they were uncomfortable being around someone who's gay or lesbian. The fraction of Americans who thought being gay should be illegal went from half to a quarter. 90% of the country said they would, for instance, feel equally comfortable with a gay salesperson. More than 70% said they'd be comfortable with a gay doctor, a gay presidential appointee, or a gay member of the armed forces. Fear and discrimination hadn't gone away, but openness had doubled in one generation. Not that straight Americans have cause to pat themselves on the back. Of course, the lion's share of credit for gay acceptance goes to the brave everyday people, including a huge number in the entertainment industry, both behind and in front of the camera, who told the world they were gay, even though they knew they would be persecuted. Surveys show that getting to know someone who is gay has a lot to do with changing people's attitudes. And what do we really do when we get to know someone? We share stories. We relive the comedies and dramas of our past. We gab about what we're going through, in the restaurant, in the bar, in the break room, at the dinner table. Unfortunately, There's a dark side to the power of stories. It has to do with the balance theory we learned about in the last chapter. For much of the 19th and early 20th centuries, the stories that went around about Asians in America had a huge effect on popular sentiment toward them, and not in a good way. Books, radio, and early television portrayed Asians as either evil or witless. This gave schools and employers an excuse to deny them opportunities. The Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor was a true story made into a false pretense to incarcerate 120,000 Japanese Americans. Note the absence of data in these decisions. Stories overrode logic. How often have you heard someone try to kill a statistic with an anecdote? Well, I read on the internet that there's this one guy who... This is classic balance theory at work. Imagine our balance theory diagram with the stick figure. He has no opinion of the triangle labeled Japan, and no opinion of the octagon labeled Japanese people. Though he assumes that Japan thinks Japanese people are good. After he sees the nation of Japan bomb Hawaii, he decides Japan is bad, and therefore, in order to keep balance, that Japanese people must be bad too. This is bad logic. Skewed balance turns a fearful story into mass guilt by association. Unfortunately, it's also effective, because here's the crux. Instead of turning on oxytocin, fearful stories give our brains an excuse to fire up our amygdala. One of the most devastating examples of this took place during the Vietnam War. U.S. soldiers killed thousands of Vietnamese civilians after their leaders plied them with stories of how the Viet Cong were evil. In 1971, Corporal John Gaiman told the press that troops were taught, quote, "It doesn't make any difference what you do to them. They're not human." As historian Nick Terse, citing the mountain of documented evidence on Vietnam war crimes buried in the National Archives, put it, the idea was that the Vietnamese, they weren't really people. From the moment soldiers entered basic training, he continued, they were told, never call them Vietnamese. Call them gooks or dinks, slopes, slants, rice eaters. Anything to take away their humanity, to dehumanize them, and make it easy to see any Vietnamese, all Vietnamese, as the enemy. This resulted in rapes, executions of children and elderly, and using civilians for target practice. This in turn led to brutal retaliations and, in the end, thousands of soldiers coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder, unable to shake what they'd seen. This is not new in the history of warfare. One of the most effective ways to rally people to do unspeakable things to other humans is to use stories that take away their humanity. Isn't this what the Nation of Islam was doing in the early days, back when they taught that whites were devils? How could it be wrong to hate whites if whites aren't human? That Yaqub story really did a number. X and others who left or reformed the sect later regretted using it to do something reminiscent of what racist whites had done in dehumanizing blacks with their own stories. Dehumanizing stories are an essential element of homophobia, too. Pundits have deployed anecdotes to support the argument that gays aren't people, therefore gays aren't protected by the Constitution. Other dehumanizing stories include early horror films portraying monsters as thinly veiled metaphors for gayness, and absurd stories about predatory gay men turning straight men gay. These baseless anecdotes linger in folklore alongside vampires, kidney themes, and the Loch Ness Monster. Stories have power. Stories can activate oxytocin and empathy, or they can turn on primal fear. Like fire, like steel, like nuclear energy, stories can be used for evil or for good. On the good front, we find Li Zhang Shen, PhD at Penn State. In the late 2000s and early 2010s, Shen devised a cool set of science experiments wherein test subjects would sit down to watch public service announcements about the dangers of cigarettes. While some watched ads centered on the familiar scare tactics, tracheotomies, amputations, and the like, others watched ads designed to make them feel empathy for people affected by smoking. Think things like brave children coping with lung damage from secondhand smoke. Shen found that both types of ads led some people to change their attitudes about smoking, but the fear-invoking ads had less of an effect. In fact, scary ads made many test subjects more resistant to changing their minds. Subjects reported that scare tactics put them on the defensive, making them feel as if their freedom to choose was under attack. But empathy-inducing ads met no such resistance. These ads made people want to change on their own, no threat required. Dr. Shen's findings have been corroborated by other research. Researchers in other fields have encountered the same phenomenon, among them CEO Robert Perez, founder of the consulting group Wonder. In his work, Perez has shown that people are more willing to do something scary, such as reverse a long-held belief about something they consider important, if they feel empathy toward the person trying to persuade them. In one example, business owners who were afraid of hiring ex-convicts heard a presentation from another business owner in the same market. When their peer told them how hiring ex-cons could actually be an advantage, Perez found that business owners were far more likely to change their minds than if they heard the same pitch from anyone else. Perhaps this is why, similarly, research shows it's more effective for a stranger of our own race or gender to persuade us to stop doing things that are racist or sexist than it is for a stranger from our out-group to make the attempt. We have more built-in openness to people who we perceive as in-group. Therefore, we're more amenable to their heartfelt plea that we get our shit together. Ironic. Because stories are so good at inducing empathy, they help us become open even to people we can't relate to. Imagine you're a manager, and you're having a hard time dealing with two bickering team members. They have different perspectives, and they aren't open to one another's ideas. Imagine you sit the two of them down together and announce that you're going to fire them, both, if they don't get along. What outcome would you predict? I think we'd both agree chances are good they'll take your threat seriously and stop openly fighting, but they won't like each other. You scared them into changing their behavior, but not their hearts. You've scared them into organizational silence. Now imagine instead that you took these same two team members and told them they have to go to dinner together. No talking shop, it's forbidden. They have to tell each other stories about their lives, where they grew up, how they met the most important people in their lives, their 10 best, their blooper reel, that sort of thing. Can you imagine them walking into work the next day, having a little more empathy for each other, treating each other a little better, even, dare I say, having each other's backs, considering each other's ideas? This is the power of stories. Jonathan McBride, the former assistant to President Obama in charge of staffing for the White House, has put this exact technique into practice at BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, where he was a managing director at the time of this writing. Over several years, McBride and his associates developed a methodology for bringing different people together. BlackRock had made a big push for cognitive diversity, and all the sorts of demographic diversity that should come with it, but over the years had run into the same things that we saw earlier with our failed mergers and team breakups. Different people can have a tough time getting along. If you're in the minority in a group, you're likely to get quiet. If your group has too much tension, the whole group can lapse into organizational silence. The upshot of a push like BlackRock's for more different team members was a lack of a feeling of belonging. McBride and his team did all sorts of little things to help reverse this, to help BlackRock employees feel like they could belong to a superordinate group, even though they might be different. This included training leaders to be conscious of opportunities for positive microactions, as Keith Yamashita taught us earlier. But the most powerful thing BlackRock did was teach people, employees and managers alike, to bond through sharing their personal stories with each other. These storytelling interventions, among other work, have led the company to become one of Fortune's most admired companies, one of Human Rights Watch's best places to work for LGBT rights, and one of LinkedIn's top companies where the world wants to work. You need people to care about each other, McBride says, and how you get people to care is through emotional narrative. Part 7. In late 2017, I flew to Los Angeles to visit Dr. Zach's neuro laboratory. There, on a Sunday morning, he strapped a device to me called an immersion sensor, which measures the downstream effects of oxytocin production in your brain. It does this by tracking changes in the vagus nerve, which is a big nerve that goes from your brain to your heart. After strapping me up, Zach had me watch a video. It was a commercial for HP, in which a father is trying to be a good dad to his teenage daughter. Throughout the video, he does nice things for her, and she ignores him or rolls her eyes like a typical moody teenager. At one point, he takes a photo with her, which she's grouchy about. She later opens her lunchbox at school to find this photo and a note from her dad. She quickly hides it. Finally, the dad comes home after a long day of work, says hi to his daughter, who ignores him once more. He then walks sadly into her room. There, he looks around at all the signs that his little girl is growing up. He sighs and lies down on the bottom bunk of the bed she shares with her sibling and looks at the ceiling. And on that ceiling, he sees that his daughter has secretly saved all of the photos that he'd taken with her over the years. Are you tearing up? I was. Dr. Zach showed me the screen on which he was monitoring my oxytocin, and it showed very clearly where I started to experience empathy for this father. Throughout the video, I got little spikes of oxytocin as he tried to be a good dad, and at the end, I experienced an enormous surge of it. I wasn't a father. I didn't know this guy in the video. I knew it was a fictional story. I had no reason to relate to his character. But after watching this little story, I felt for him. I liked the guy. I wanted to hug him. This effect, Dr. Zach explained to me, is melting that self-other divide. Positive social encounters release oxytocin, things like hugs, acts of kindness, and emotional stories. This oxytocin helps build relationships between people who are different, even people who are not inclined to accept each other. If you release oxytocin naturally, Zach explains, the in-group, out-group bias disappears. I want to make sure you caught that. When our brains release oxytocin for a person who is not in our in-group, the bias we have for them disappears. And one of the key ways we can do that is through sharing good stories. In the 1960s, the stories about Asian Americans went from scurrilous to approving. A lot of Americans developed greater empathy for their Asian neighbors, relating to them, respecting them, differences and all, allowing them opportunities long denied. And this was partly thanks to Fumiko and Takekuma's son, George. Part 8. In 1966, television producer Gene Roddenberry made a phone call to a young Japanese-American actor he had heard good things about. Roddenberry was working on a science fiction show that would feature a diverse cast of problem-solving space adventurers. He wanted an Asian man to play the role of the spaceship pilot. The show was called Star Trek. Its lead would be heartthrob William Shatner as the dashing Captain Kirk. Kirk's comrades, Leonard Nimoy as the wise Spock, DeForest Kelly as the sarcastic Dr. Bones McCoy, and former jazz singer Nichelle Nichols as communications officer Uhura. And in one of the first positive, de-stereotyped roles for an Asian-American actor in Hollywood history, Star Trek would also star 29-year-old George Takei as the brave and clever Lieutenant Sulu. Lieutenant Sulu didn't speak in a bogus accent. He didn't have insulting teeth, and he didn't blunder around crashing into things, the threadbare TV tropes of the day. Takei's character spoke precise English, with that rich bass of his, and masterfully piloted the USS Enterprise. As an Asian American, you always felt a real strong sense of excitement when you saw Asian people on TV, recalls Tony Award-winning actor B.D. Wong in a documentary about Takei's life. And what's amazing to me now is how often those Asian people that you saw on TV were embarrassing. But Sulu wasn't embarrassing. No yukata, no goatee, no sinister plotting. Sulu wore a Starship Command uniform and coolly collaborated with crew members. They trusted him with their lives. This was novel, and to B.D. Wong, this was an omen of change. George, Wong recalled, was this kind of beacon of dignity. As Star Trek became a cultural phenomenon, George Takei's positive portrayal of Sulu reached millions. Takei was one of the first actors to tell a new story about Asian Americans. Thus, when a young athlete was discovered at a martial arts exhibition in Long Beach in 1964, Bruce Lee was able to shatter the glass ceiling Takei had cracked. Pop culture experts believe that Takei's pioneering role paved the way for Lee's international stardom. New stereotypes were emerging. Hollywood was pushing the image of the Asian savant or the Asian action hero. Meanwhile, Chinatown, perhaps ironically, was pushing the image of the upstanding Asian, working to supplant the old stereotype of the degenerate Asian in the press. Quote, the model minority myth as we see it today was mainly an unintended outcome of earlier attempts by Asian Americans to be accepted and recognized as human beings, said Dr. Ellen Wu of Indiana University. Wu's book, The Color of Success, documents Asian Americans' struggle for acceptance in the mid-20th century. They wanted to be seen as American people who were worthy of respect and dignity. The Chinatown leaders were really smart. They started to peddle stories about Chinese traditional family values and Confucian ethics. They claimed that Chinese children always listened to their elders, were unquestioningly obedient, and never got into trouble because after school, they would just go to Chinese school. Smart? Yes. But people are people. Kids are kids. Of course, some Asian American children were obedient, and some not. Some Asian American families were close-knit, and some not. The thing that actually changed between the time George Takei was imprisoned and the time George Takei was offered a part in Star Trek was the story. Asian Americans themselves remained fundamentally the same, good human beings deserving of inclusion and curiosity and respect. But the story being told about Asian Americans, at the school board meeting, in the newspaper, on the silver screen, was dramatically different in 1972 from what it had been in 1942. You'll recall how Dr. Hilger's research concluded that Asian Americans in the 1940s and 50s were simply held back by a lack of opportunities. As the stories about them changed, the opportunities came. They seized them. This bred more good stories and more positive exposure to mainstream Americans, which in turn bred more opportunities. Discrimination is still alive and well in America, but Takei's and other stories helped to open people's hearts. More mainstream Americans started letting Asians on the team. Part 9. So who likes stats? In my mind's eye, I see every hand go up. Hello, fellow nerds. And who likes books? You, presumably, since you've come this far. Well, if you like books, you're going to love this next stat. As a writer of books, I know I did. In 2017, I took Dr. Kumre Mancuso and Dr. Rouse's assessment for intellectual humility and added a few questions of my own. Demographic information, where you've lived, where you've traveled, plus several other things. I asked thousands of people to take this test, and as we discussed in the last chapter, I found a delightful connection between living or traveling abroad and intellectual humility. One of the questions I asked involved traveling somewhere a little less expensive, into books. People who read a book or more per month, the data show, are significantly more likely to have IH than those who rarely read. Reading lots of books means we're taking in lots of stories about lots of people and things. Is it really a quantum leap to suggest that doing so will give us a little more openness toward the people we meet in everyday life? In 2010, a professor named Dr. Dahlia Baskerville of Victoria University put this theory to the test when she brought a bunch of young students from different cultural backgrounds together for story time. She found that when kids participated in story time together, sharing stories about themselves, their cultures, and other things they cared about, it, quote, fostered empathy, compassion, tolerance, and respect for difference. These kids grew up to be a little less xenophobic than their peers. In 2014, Dr. Zach proved this same effect from a neuroscience angle in a project for DARPA. Zach's lab, the Center for Neuroeconomic Studies at Claremont University, once again hooked people up to brain chemical tracking devices. It found that inspiring stories across outgroups made people less xenophobic toward those groups and more likely to donate to causes that supported them. The most powerful of these experiments involved an animated video of a little black boy who wanted to be an astronaut. The adult real-life brother of this boy narrated how his brother, Ronald McNair, once had a librarian call the police on him when he asked to check out books from the library. The police told the librarian to let him have the books. Ronald loved to watch Star Trek, and while his brother thought the idea of people of multiple races, including a black person, working together on a spaceship was pure science fiction, Ronald called it science possibility. Eventually, Ronald became a physicist, and the second African-American astronaut in history. Tragically, he died aboard the Challenger shuttle in 1986. And the library that once tried to deny him books renamed itself after him. People in Zach's lab who watched this animation showed all the signs of empathy, generated oxytocin, shared heartfelt comments about the story, and donated a lot of money to an African-American related charity when asked afterward, regardless of their own race. Narrative transportation was the strongest predictor of charitable behavior, the center wrote, referring to the viewers' reports of being pulled in by such a good story, followed by the experience of empathic concern. Race didn't matter when people saw the story. Ronald McNair was a human being and part of their team. It is melting that self-other divide. If you release oxytocin naturally, the in-group-out-group bias disappears. My research shows how books can be a great way to experience stories and open our hearts this way. Gallup and Pew research about gay rights attitudes shows us how stories on the screen help us do this too. The Victoria University study and the positive results at BlackRock show how stories from one person to another help us feel like part of the same team. Dr. Zach's DARPA study showed us how watching a cartoon about a black kid's dream of going to space and his subsequent death aboard the Challenger space shuttle, after becoming a groundbreaking physicist, made people of all races feel more connected to and empathy for black people. Knowing this, we shouldn't be at all surprised by what happened when George Takei and other Japanese Americans shared their story with Washington. In 1983, the Congressional Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians, CWRIC, formally admitted the grave injustice the United States had done by interning Japanese Americans. Since 1980, the CWRIC had been holding public hearings around the country, learning the experiences of Japanese Americans whose lives were upended during the war. More than 750 people testified, among them George Takei, who spoke at hearings held in Los Angeles in August of 1981. George told the commission about being forced into that camp. He told them about playing inside the barbed wire fences, in the shadow of the machine guns. He shared how his parents' hopes and plans and hard-earned home ownership goals had been crushed for no better reason than the way they looked. Takei's story stirred empathy with the public, and it resonated with members of Congress. The CWRIC report was instrumental in President Reagan's decision to sign the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, which included a small, mostly symbolic, monetary apology to survivors of the camps. 1942 was a long time ago, but these stories still made people care. And they made a difference. But internment wasn't the only way George Takei had been confined by prejudice. For the first 68 years of his life, Takei never spoke on the record about being gay, though it had been an increasingly open secret among fans since the 70s. George had made a name for himself in Hollywood at a time when a California law allowing involuntary sterilization of homosexual people was still on the books. For decades, George had lived with the tension between who he was and who the public wanted him to be. But when then-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed a California same-sex marriage bill in 2005, George Takei felt he had to take a stand. After formally coming out in an issue of Frontiers magazine, Takei launched Equality Trek, a speaking tour that brought his story to college campuses around the United States. Takei had long been active in California politics and LGBT organizations, but with Equality Trek, George was taking his story nationwide. And can you guess what happened? To thousands of fans, George the actor became George the person. George Takei helped college kids and Trekkies alike see the gay rights movement for what it is, a quest for the equal protection of ordinary people under the law. As social media grew, Takei used his fame, his story, and his sense of humor to build a gigantic Facebook following. More than a decade after formally coming out, George Takei was still sharing stories to build support for social justice. In 2013, he was declared the most influential person on Facebook, having touched tens of millions of people through sharing stories, both funny and heartfelt, about human beings deserving of the world's empathy and respect. At the time of this writing, Takei was screening a Broadway musical he created called Allegiance, about the Japanese internment camps he grew up in. It was just another way to use stories to teach about how locking Japanese Americans up in 1941 and discriminating against gay couples in 2017 are just different symptoms of the same disease, excluding people because of who they are. Winning respect for Asian Americans was not a solo project, nor was winning gay rights. By sharing his story and playing a part in the stories of Star Trek and others, Takei helped recruit collaborators in both efforts. He helped build the gigantic dream team of people that every social movement needs to make progress. If storytelling could do all that, imagine what sharing our stories can do at smaller scales. Imagine how stories might help humanize those with whom we have tension, in our partnerships, our companies, our coalitions, our causes, our families. Imagine what stories might do for our teams when we haven't developed the respect and intellectual humility to properly harness our differences together. Imagine how those stories might help us to learn to love the people we fear instead of shutting them down. Part 10. In 1967, as Star Trek began its second season of filming, George Takei arrived one morning to his dressing room to a surprise. Inside the room were two costumes. While Takei had been filming a side project, the screenwriters had written in another character to work as the ship's co-commander. Walter Koenig, playing the character Pavel Chekhov, would now be sharing the helm with Takei. Takei was furious. "I'll admit it, I hated him," he recalled. He was jealous that someone else would be splitting the role he had worked hard to develop. "The veins in my scalp started to swell up." When Koenig showed up to the dressing room, the first words out of his mouth were, "I hate this." "Well, I don't like it any better," Takei retorted. Koenig hesitated. "You do too?" "Of course," Takei said. "I don't like it any better than you do." "Well, at least you don't have to wear it," Koenig said. Takei then realized that Koenig had not been talking about having to work together. He was talking about the floppy wig in his hands that the producers were making him wear. Embarrassed, Takei set aside his temper for a moment and let Koenig talk. As he listened to the man's story, Takei's heart began to soften. He learned that Koenig had also attended UCLA, that he had a brother who worked in medicine, that he had been working long and hard for an acting break so his family would respect his career choice. "I saw that he was an ambitious actor, excited by the opportunity of being part of a quality television series, just like me," Takei said. The hate that had tempered down to pity, then tolerance, was now softening to a recognition of our matching lives and shared ambitions. After learning Koenig's story, Takei couldn't help but swallow his pride and work with the man. "We were in this together," he said. So they teamed up. They leaned on each other. They commanded the Starship Enterprise together. And the image of Sulu and Chekhov sharing its console became one of the iconic images of not only Star Trek, but of the kaleidoscopic dream team that humankind could one day become in Earth's actual future. And 40 years later, when George Takei married his sweetheart Brad in Los Angeles, Walter Koenig was his best man. Epilogue. I want to end this book by telling you about the worst day of my life. You wouldn't think it was the worst day by the way it started. That's what's so ironic. My day started at the new Soho offices of my growing company, which after 3 years of 100-hour work weeks had become a real business and had at that point created more than 50 jobs. I'd started it with two friends and a stack of credit cards. We'd poured everything into it, this dream that was finally coming true. After a good day's work, I left my friends at the office and hustled uptown to interview a famous billionaire on stage in front of 1,000 people at Columbia University. We'd be talking about the launch of his latest book, and a little bit about my first, which I'd published a week before, fulfilling a fantasy I'd had since I was in middle school. At the time, it was the largest crowd I'd ever spoken in front of. Afterward, I quickly shook hands with everyone and ran out the door. I grabbed the one train downtown to Soho House, a fancy social club where people richer and cooler than me hobnobbed and drank wine. A group called the Influencers had invited me to speak about my work to an intimate gathering of smart and famous people, musicians and entrepreneurs and heads of advertising and modeling agencies. The crowd included one of my childhood heroes, Bill Nye the Science Guy. My speech was a hit. I was on fire. After the presentation, Bill Nye shook my hand and congratulated me on my work. World champion beatboxer Razel stopped me on my way out and said he couldn't wait to read my book. It was just after 1 a.m. by the time I got out of there, with a pocket full of business cards. I walked out the Soho House doors onto the cobblestone streets of the meatpacking district. And then, I remembered that I had no place to sleep that night. You see, I was homeless. While on the outside, I was at this great inflection point in my career. On the inside, I was suffering from the worst series of emotional setbacks I'd ever faced. It had started with a cancer scare and ended in a surprise divorce request, everything at once. Subsequent hasty negotiations had left me broke, depressed, homeless, and wondering whether any of this work stuff even mattered. Only a few people in my life had much idea what was going on with me behind the scenes. I hadn't even mustered the courage to tell my family, much less my employees. I was co-running a business worth millions, but secretly unable to afford a deposit on an apartment. Rather than asking a friend to let me crash for the 3 months I'd need to save up for a rent deposit on an apartment, I'd been bouncing from couch to couch, keeping details light and feeding off the generosity of pals and acquaintances, and trying not to burden any one friend unduly. This was obviously a dumb plan. But, having been a bastion of stability and sobriety for 29 years, I was now spiraling out of control in both senses. I was too anxious to talk with people about my situation, and wouldn't allow myself to stay with anyone for too long, for fear that I would have to fess up to having passed out on a park bench or the L train a few too many times, or to talk about how I was feeling. And in the frenzy of this day's speeches and events, a day that should have been one of my greatest, I had once again forgotten to arrange somewhere to stay. I pulled out my phone. It had only 1% battery power left. I frantically texted my friend Nat to ask if I could crash. The phone died. And then, as if the universe were filming some sort of tragic movie, the clouds above New York began spilling their guts. I slumped down onto the curb. Sitting there in the rain on the corner of 9th Avenue and 14th Street, with the backpack that contained my entire life in it, I broke down. I had never felt this alone. All the years of work I'd put in, all the hours and weeks and months and sacrifices to get to this day that should have been so happy. Everyone in that auditorium thought I was such a success. Everyone at Soho House assumed I had everything going for me. I couldn't feel more opposite. After a few minutes and more than a few deep breaths, I fumbled around my bag for the keys to my office and started a rainy 2-mile trudge. Anyone who is lucky enough to be alive has a lot to be grateful for. I knew that. For a variety of reasons, I had it better than a whole lot of people out there. But that didn't make me feel better. I didn't know whether I wanted to put one foot in front of the other anymore, or not. You're listening to this book because a group of people helped me find my footing again. The first was a man named David Carr. He was a columnist for the New York Times who, after writing about my company a year before, had become a friend. He'd call me occasionally to talk about stories he was working on, or for help with some tech-related thing for the new college class he was teaching. Shortly after that night at Soho House, I was tromping around New York with my backpack, killing time, ruminating about the point of it all. My cell phone rang. It was the raspy voice of Mr. David Carr. He launched into whatever it was he had on his mind. But after a moment, he stopped. Something was wrong. "What was it?" he asked. David was good at getting people to cough up information. I cracked. I unloaded all the gory details. I told David everything. He listened, said a few curse words on my behalf, and told me about the times that he, a former crack addict with a divorce and a few jail stints under his belt, hit rock bottom himself. And then he told me the words that no one else would tell me. "It's going to hurt, and that's okay." For whatever reason, that acknowledgement was a wave of relief. Avoiding the pain was only prolonging it. And besides, if he'd been through things like this and become the world-famous writer and happy family man that he now was, I didn't have to worry that I could pull myself up too. And as a side note, devastatingly, and for many, many more people than just me, David passed away a couple of months after this. But he kept checking in on me up until then. I got a tattoo in his memory. I'll never forget him. The second member of Team Resuscitate Shane was my apprentice, Erin. She had signed on for a few months to help run things in my company while in between a couple of her own ventures. Little did I know when I hired her, she was also a spiritual giant with a heart of gold. As people at work started to hear rumors about what was going on, I got lots of, "Are you all right?" and "It's going to be all right." Erin, on the other hand, forced me to stop and do breathing exercises. She made me go to yoga class. She gave me pep talks. She got all Buddhist on me. And she said what I actually needed to hear. I listened to what she said, and I got through it. It's not easy to admit to yourself that you can't solve all your problems yourself. But doing so helped me move forward during that dark time, and every dark period since, instead of staying stuck on my own suboptimal mountain peak, mired in my own fear. The real lesson that I learned during that brief and devastating period of my life is not about any particular coping mechanism for grief or self-pity. It's that the best way to make progress when the going gets tough is with each other. David and Aaron, and all the rest who helped pull me out of the abyss, my partners Joe and Dave, my dear friends Laser and Jess and Simon and Frank and Costa and Maria, and even you, John Levy, were the combination of wonderful and disparate people that I needed to break through and move forward. They were my dream team. The most important things are made easier, made possible, together. Sometimes those things are as small as changing the world. Sometimes they're as big as changing a life. This is Shane Snow. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Dream Teams, Working Together Without Falling Apart. This program was directed by Lewis Milgram, engineered by Gina Vosti, executive producer Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2018 by Shane Snow. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.